we want to discuss today is kind of reviewing these first 4 centuries now in regard to how Sunday came to be established as the Christian day of worship. Very interesting study, which we will only, of course, scratch the surface of today. I want to mention a few works that will be good for you to study. Perhaps the best work that you can have available either in the library or for you to purchase on your own. I keep meaning to purchase this and keep forgetting it, so you'll probably do the same. A very hard to spell name, but well done work called From Sunday to Sabbath. Excuse me. From Sabbath to Sunday. I got it reversed. From Sabbath to Sunday. Written by Samuel, and you Italians, please forgive me, Bacciocchi, if that's anywhere near correct. Is that close? Bacciocchi. B-A-C-C. Let me write it on the board, in fact. B-A-C-C-H-I-O-C-C-H-I. Samuel Bacciocchi. 7th-day Adventist work from, forgotten the name of the college in Michigan. Do any of you know where he teaches? 7th-day Adventist College, I think it's in, maybe it's Wisconsin. Andrews College or University? Andrews University, I assume, is Seventh-day Adventist. I'm not as familiar with the man, Mr. Carl McNair, who is pastor of our church now over in Tucson. Used to be up in Milwaukee and became acquainted with this man and has had some meetings with him, has heard him lecture, and certainly has a great deal of respect for him. Sometime it would be nice perhaps to have someone like that here, because he does have a vast amount of knowledge, and while we would not have subscribed to every Seventh-day Adventist approach in the subject, it doesn't hurt. Someone else has done your work for you. That's the nice thing about a book like this. You know, oh, it's a Seventh-day Adventist book. I can go do my own work. Oh, fine, you know. I'll go do your own work, but here it is, all in one volume. So why should you go reinvent the wheel? Well done work. There's some flaws in it, but overall it's well done. It's nicely footnoted. You'll see on some pages the footnotes are as long as the text. See, this is footnote, text, footnote. So it's got a lot of source material. In the back, then is a listing of the primary sources that he used, a bibliography in the back of the book, quoting the original sources, or the earliest sources he could find on given subjects, and even then after his primary sources, has a book of secondary sources, lesser used works, or less authoritative works. So it's the one weakness in it, I feel, is not indexed. So you have to kind of flow through. But he shows the origins of Sunday worship, the pagan, pre-Christian significance of Sunday, and how the church came to be keeping that day. So it's a work I can recommend for you to study in this regard, but it should be used as a reference tool. We may not draw all conclusions exactly like he does. Another Seventh-day Adventist author of a little earlier time that you should be familiar with is a man named A. H. Lewis. A. H. Lewis. Abraham Herbert, if you want it all. But usually goes by the name of A. H. Who is also affiliated with Seventh-day Adventist late in the last century, 1890, to have a little earlier perspective of this work. And his work is entitled, he has several. You go to the library and look under Lewis, you'll find 4 or 5 different works by him. The one I brought just to show you is A Critical History of Sabbath and Sunday. A Critical History of the Sabbath and the Sunday, to get it all correct. Written, let's see, I better put on my glasses. I think I said 1890s, but I can't read it. Funny when your eyes go on you, all of a sudden, boom. Late 40s happens to you. Warn you in advance. 1886 was the date of publication, 1886. So you have a work, again, that hard to come by. This, in fact, we have in our own library is a Xerox of a book, and then it's been bound by a book bindery. And sometimes that's the only way to get some of these older works. You just Xerox them if you want to take the expense to do it, and then you either put them in a loose-leaf book or have them bound at a bindery. What's it usually cost? $12-$13 to bind a book, something like that. It's pretty expensive. So three-ring binder is $1.25, whatever. A little easier. And another work, I'll just refer to it briefly, The Christian Sabbath by Haynes. The Christian Sabbath. Is it Saturday or Sunday? H-A-Y-N-E-S. So with that, you can go into much greater depth than I'll give you today. I'm only going to hit some then of the highlights. Some of the sources I'll quote come from this. Some of them I'm just quoting the authors themselves. And then there are a number of other works. Mostly, I would not expect you to memorize or be familiar with any of the other materials or the lesser-known quotes. I think you're all probably let me also refer to our own booklet I just brought along. But we do not discuss in our own booklet on the Sabbath the history of the changeover. We merely show the history of the Sabbath from its beginnings, and that it's the day God always designed, the day they kept until Jesus, the day Jesus kept, the day the early church kept, and the day we should keep. And so we don't go into the detail of showing what happened in the meantime in our own literature. We have articles that we have published in the past, but generally hard to get a hold of. They're in older issues of the Good News and not so readily available and not in reprint form. But, of course, if you want to do a study on the Sabbath day, that's a whole different thing, and I'm not going to go into all of that. But just give you an overview how Sunday came to be the day of worship in the Christian church, because it has to be puzzling. When you look into the Bible and you see that the Sabbath was observed by Jesus, it was observed by the apostles, what happened from 30 A.D., 31 A.D., when the church was established, until we see by the time of the Council of Nicaea, we again come to that sort of magic date for demarcation, that Sunday is firmly established as the day of worship in the Catholic Church. What happened in those little better than three, or a little less than three centuries of time? It's a difficult story to put together decisively, because nobody says we did it here and there's a date and this event. It just evolved over the course of time, but here's sort of how it did. Before we come to the New Testament time, though, I think you should be familiar, I started to say a moment ago, with the general acceptance of Sunday in the pagan religious systems of the pre-Christian time. The sun god, in most cases, was to be venerated above other gods, and the sun held particular worship significance, especially at the time in December when the winter solstice came and the sun, the days were getting shorter, and it looked to them, without a knowledge of science, that the world was going to come to an end because every day was getting a minute shorter, and given another, period of time, we're going to all be nighttime universally, and then we'll freeze to death. So when the sun was, quote, reborn, end quote, and the days began to get a few seconds longer in late December and then a minute longer as you turn the year, they had special services to worship the sun late in December and early in January. Just always has been done. And the story of that kind of worship can be found in a number of historic books. We often quote, and I didn't intend to mention it, I'm going to have to call it to mind, The Golden Bough is one book. Now, what's the other more common one we quote from in those pagan sources? Why won't it come to my mind? I hate that when your mind goes blank. The Two Babylons by Hyslop. Simultaneously. The Two Babylons by Hyslop, which shows the pagan derivation of many different kinds of customs. Now, I will ask you to please exercise caution when you read The Two Babylons or The Golden Bough or any other books that describe modern customs in the light of pagan tradition. Most of those authors go overboard. And then we go overboard about their going overboard, and we stand up and give fiery sermons and go way out on the limb and talk about all these things that happen, and somebody who really knows what he's talking about comes along and knocks your props out from under you, and it makes your whole thesis look ridiculous. The thesis is okay. Many modern customs come to us out of ancient pagan rituals. That's a plain, easy-to-prove statement. But when you get into all of these other things, you can make, you might have read the little thing Reader's Digest did one time on
the pagan derivation of American football. Some of you who are internationals may agree with this. But it was really well done. I mean, it was done in the historical, documented, footnoted style, and it talked about the football and its shape as an egg and passing it between the legs of the center, and it went through all the sexual innuendo about passing off the ovum, and it was kind of, you know, bawdy, I suppose, but it really sounded like, man, it just sounded so authentic. And it was written totally tongue-in-cheek and for fun and all that, but, you know, it sounded like it was so true that this is, the whole thing has its origins in ancient pagan sex worship. And it was some guy just making a parody on it. And only if you play soccer would you go along with that, see? Or what you may call football if you live internationally to us. So you can carry these things too far. And I have seen a number of our own ministers, you know, more in years gone by, get up and using books like the Two Babylons as, pseudo-scripture almost, and drawing conclusions that should not have been drawn, and carrying it much too far. I just ask you to use caution. But there is no difficulty in establishing and using these books to help you. Maybe the best thing they can do to help you is give you another source, not their own, but their footnotes and their indexes and their appendices and their bibliographies are a good source to you. Then you can go back and you can get what information you want to give in a sermon or write in an article at some point in the future. The day of the sun, though, is from ancient times a day of observation of festivities of one kind or another, and was worshipped in the time of Baal. Was always something the Israelites and the Jews had to contend with, and the surrounding nations round about them, and was always, of course, very pagan. Now we have an anti-Semitic world, which we have talked about, that is, opposed to the Jewish people. And the Romans were among a very notable group of anti-Semitists in history. Did a great deal to persecute the entire Jewish community from time to time. We have talked about Christian persecutions in the first 3 or 4 centuries. But we also should know that many of these were simultaneous with Jewish persecutions, and the whole thing had to do with religion, in part at least. So a lot of the shifting tide of thought among the Gentile Christians in the Roman community no doubt had to do with anti-Semitism, as we'll see. But that wasn't all of it. We have a note in a work that I will not bother to have you put down, but the Latin title of the book is Deus Dominici, Dominica, the Day of the Lord, in the Latin, which merely the statement is, I just bring this up because I like the statement, the year A.D. 70 marks the decisive break between Sabbath and Sunday. Now, this is someone looking back on it. You may say, well, that's a bit early, isn't it? A.D. 70. Because I think we can clearly demonstrate from the Bible that up to the time of the fall of Jerusalem, because Paul died in 68, John carried on the work until the turn of the century, so that up until that time, there was no biblical evidence of any other observation. Why would this man observe A.D. 70 as a demarcation point? And I think the answer should come quite clear, that as a result of anti-Semitism and or Jewish uprising, whichever way you prefer to word it, that is, the Jews revolted against Rome in 66, remember, and by 70... the Romans had essentially destroyed Judaism and the homeland of the Jews, and thus Sabbath observance from 70 A.D. in the Jewish or Christian community would have been very difficult because of Roman persecution. So when you look back at what was happening, you see severe persecution of the Jews, including the total destruction of the city of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. and Jews fleeing for your life. You've probably all heard, at least in part, the story of the Jewish holdout after the destruction down on Masada. And if you ever go to Israel, you'll certainly want to make the effort to see Masada down on the Dead Sea. An extra day, but well worth the trip down to see and to experience as much as you would there what the Jews did in withholding the Romans for some little time. But finally, the Romans won that battle too, of course. Well, it depends on how you figure one. The Jews all died anyway. Most of them committed suicide. So you have, at that time, a tremendous breakdown of Judaism, Roman persecution throughout the empire on Jew and Christian alike, and thus it's very difficult to observe the Sabbath. At the same time, you have an emerging Gentile element within the church bringing in the pagan philosophies and thoughts. Bacciocci says in his book, I quote from him, page 171, if you'd like the reference, I assume all editions are the same, but it may not be. Rome adopted new political and fiscal policies against the Jews. Under Vespasian, AD 69 to 79, both the Sanhedrin and the office of the high priest were abolished, and worship at the temple site was forbidden. The Emperor Hadrian, AD 117 to 148, outlawed the practice of Jewish religion and particularly the observance of the Sabbath. So any Sabbath observance in the Roman Empire at this time is going to be done quietly and privately, as the church had basically always done when you get down to it. Paul went to the Jewish synagogue, you know, and sometimes enough in the synagogue were converted that they would use that, but most of the time not. Generally speaking, they then began to meet in the homes, the private homes of people in the town or community where Paul and his followers were. And we don't see evidence of particularly large congregations. Sometimes we may observe the notation of a hired hall where they might have rented a facility for a service. So you see, Sabbath is very difficult to observe, yet it is still the Sabbath, and it has always been called the Sabbath. An interesting observation over a long period of time, and it's still true in the Catholic world, of those who know. I mean, you can go on the street and ask a Catholic person, you know, which day is the Sabbath, and they probably will say Sunday, as many Protestants would, or they will note that it was changed from Saturday to Sunday. But the official recognition of the Catholic Church is Saturday always was, and still is today, the Sabbath of the Bible. That is not a bone of contention with the Roman Catholic Church. They know Saturday is the Sabbath. Now, I'll read you a couple of early quotes on that, but you can find modern ones in some of the literature if you want to take the time to look them up. What happened then, off and on in these first three centuries, is that the Sabbath was being retained as a day of worship in some parts of the Christian community. Other parts of the Christian community, primarily divided east and west, were observing Sunday, but that you find a continuation of both days being observed even in the Catholic Church for a period of time. In fact, in the West, that is, in Italy primarily, the Sabbath continued to be a day of worship, not as we call the Sabbath, but not as we would do it, not Friday sundown to Saturday sundown, but a day of worship, of reading scriptures, a day noted as the Sabbath, until 600, and that's a rounded off figure, until 600 A.D. In the East, we can find, in the Catholic Church, continuation of special observances on the Sabbath up until 1000 A.D. And that was when the Eastern and Western churches really, once and for all, split. We'll come to that a little later. That's an interesting observation. Now, think of, if you have been in a Catholic community, even to this day, how do the Catholics regard Saturday? And you will, if you've been in a community of large Catholic population, you will probably remember a variety of church kind of activities on a Saturday. It is probably the most popular day for weddings in the Roman Catholic Church, Saturday. And other religious observation is carried out on Saturday. So it is not a day that the Catholics have totally disregarded as a day for religious significance. And early on, even up to 1000 A.D., there were plenty of evidences that the Sabbath continued to be acknowledged as the original created day. But things were evolving. By the time of the Emperor Constantine, and we've talked plenty about him, Sunday worship was officially decreed to be the state day of worship, Christians and pagans alike. I'll read you a comment on that in a minute. It was Constantine's desire to bring about unity and harmony, and he saw the church, the Catholic Church, as a vehicle for this. And so to have that unanimity in the empire, to bring it all together, he used Sunday worship services for that. And there's a great deal of controversy about the conversion of Constantine. I've mentioned that two or three times. In his work that I just referred to, A Critical History of the Sabbath by Lewis, he says this of Constantine. Although Constantine, A.D. 306 to 337, professed conversion to Christianity, he was devoted to Apollo of Greek and Roman mythology and would represent himself with symbols of the god of light and poetry. I mentioned to you already how on one side of Constantine's coins was the Christian signal of a symbol of the X and R, or P as we would view it, the first two letters of the name of Christ, and on the other side, the sun god, or the sun, which was the sun god. So Constantine maintained his pagan connections. He was a Roman pantheist, of course, until his death, at which time he was baptized and allegedly, once and for all, converted. In the other work that I referred to by Haynes, he says, two reasons why the Sabbath of the Lord was discarded and the day of sun worshippers was adopted. One, there was a strong desire to avoid being identified with the Jews, which we've commented on from time to time, whose bigotry and downfall had made them unpopular, that is, the Jews. And they were unpopular. They were, first of all, unpopular in the Roman community, always had been, never buckled under the Jews. They were always in some sort of rebellion. And so finally, the second Jewish wars in the 130s, they were really put down. Of course, Jerusalem was destroyed in 70, as we've noted. So Jews had their problems. Now, even we find in the Bible the difficulty between Christians and Jews, because the Jews were the chief persecutors of Christians for the first 30 years. And that's very biblically documented. So for 30 years, the Jews made themselves obnoxious to Christians. You could imagine if they were unconverted Christians. There is such a thing, but you understand now what I say when I use the word Christian. Anybody who has embraced some of the principles and the titles of Christianity, that there would be a strong anti-Semitic feeling in the Roman Christian community, because now they are not imbued with the Spirit of God. They don't have the spirit of cooperation. They are not seeking truth. They are evolving into their own politio-religious system. Then secondly, he says, the second reason Haynes mentions, there was an equally strong desire to win over pagan sun worshippers and gain adherence to the church. So he had two things working in the Roman Gentile Christian world. Anti-Semitism, anti-Jewish sentiment, and the desire to convert pagans, make it easy for them. This has sort of always been the way Catholics have done certain things. And when you observe, as you travel around the world, and especially the world that has been dominated by Roman Catholics, you observe many interesting customs in societies that have been converted to Catholicism, but have retained some of their own original pagan customs. I've forgotten the name of that group down in Brazil. They're quite a large group of voodoo-practicing Brazilian natives who are Christian, but continue their old pagan voodoo rituals within the confines of the church. The Mayas, the Incan civilizations of Mexico and Central and South America, the Indian population, were won over, but they were won over by military. And then Catholics came in, and they took all the babies of the Indian communities in the New World and baptized them. They were Catholics then. But then their parents brought them up to be like they always were. So you have a perpetuation of many ancient customs. If you saw Ballet Folklorico that was here at the auditorium, you saw a lot of ancient Indian custom and ritual that had little or no relationship to Christianity in some cases. And yet it's one of the strongest Catholic states in the world, Mexico. So you have that ancient history of how the Catholics win converts. They just go in, dominate them politically, and baptize them and make them Catholics. And they grow up Catholics. They grow up with Catholic ritual, but in many cases retain their old ways. So you have those things happening. We mentioned the Council of Nicaea. After that council, which was 325, remember. In the next few years, and we don't have a specific date for it, but there was an edict put out by Constantine, and it's been given the title, the Edict of Heresy. On Heresy, excuse me. The Edict on Heresy. And something very interesting now takes place. This is in the, let's say, late 320s in all probability. Here's what his Edict on Heresy states. Quote, Victor Constantius Maximus Augustus to the heretics. For as much then, and a heretic is someone who has been a believer, who is a believer, but who is now in disagreement with the church, now has fallen into a different way of thinking and a different doctrine. I'm not talking about someone who's never, ever part of it. For as much then as is no longer possible to bear with your pernicious errors, we give warning by this present statute that none of you henceforth presume to assemble yourselves together. This must be directed against those Christians in the East who could not accept the statements from the Council of Nicaea. We have directed accordingly that you be deprived of all your houses in which you are accustomed to hold your assemblies. And our care in this respect extends so far as to forbid the holding of your superstitious and senseless meetings. You didn't know how he feels about them anyway. Not in public merely, but in any private house or place whatsoever. Let those of you, therefore, who are desirous of embracing the true and pure religion, take the far better course of entering the Catholic Church and uniting with it in holy fellowship, whereby you will be enabled to arrive at the knowledge of your truth. In any case, the delusions of your perverted understandings must entirely cease to mingle with and mar the felicity of our present time. Now, that's one way to have unity. You enforce it. And this must have been directed at people who were observing the Sabbath, the Passover, the laws of unclean meat, tithing, or whatever else may have separated them in difference. We're not observing the Lenten fast. We're not observing Easter. We're not observing the Saturnalia, but who were striving to remain faithful. And he calls them heretics, and notice, here we have the Roman government giving the right of property confiscation to the Catholic Church. Pretty powerful weapon, isn't it? You can be kicked out of your home and the property deeded to the church because of what? Because of your belief. Because of your belief, you can have your property confiscated. What a testimony in human society. And the Catholic Church that has been abused by the Romans significantly now becomes, at least in part, an abusor of the authority invested in it by the Roman Emperor once it's established as the state religion in the 320s. Now, as we go back and look at these, quote, heretics, end quote, as viewed by the church, we find some interesting statements about them. Eusebius, who is, remember, at the same time of Constantine in the 300s, early 300s, says this about this same group. Thus were the lurking places of the heretics broken up by the emperor's command and the savage beasts they harbored, I mean the chief authors of their impious doctrines, given to flight. And that was after Constantine's edict. Eusebius wrote, thus were the lurking places of the heretics broken up. And that's how they view people who kept Passover, the Sabbath, presumably, although I'm reading between the lines on that. So I'm a little cautious about that, but I don't know what else they would be heretical about. Oh, you have the Arian controversy on the divinity of Jesus and some of those kind of things, all of which probably come into play. Accordingly, Numbers acknowledged the church as the mother from whom they had wandered long and to whom they now returned with joy and gladness. See, some people came back to the Catholic Church. Some people recanted. Some people who had been observing contrary practices to the Catholic, now Western way, gave up their original ways and became part of the Catholic system. Some didn't, of course. Thus the members of the entire body became united and compacted in one harmonious whole, and the one Catholic Church
at unity with itself, shown with full luster, while no heretical or schismatic body anywhere continued to exist. Well, that's what he thinks. They certainly did continue to exist. And the credit of having achieved this mighty work, our heaven-protected emperor alone, of all who had gone before him, was able to attribute to himself. Ingratiate yourself pretty well with the emperor, doesn't it? Say those nice things about him. So there was pressure from Rome through the government, and people were forced back into the Catholic Church, who had refused to participate in the Western deviation from truth. Let's go back a little bit further even. You might want your chart handy for reference so you see some of the names, you immediately fall on them unless you've already got them well committed to memory. Justin Martyr, remember, was the early 2nd century, 100 to 167 of his lifespan, and of course in his ministry. He described in his writings Sunday. So we see Sunday as a part of the church. And again, it's by observation we note some of these things. Not by any specific statement or authoritative point where you can make a good case of it. But we observe what was happening. Here's what Justin Martyr said in his writings. And on the day called Sunday, all who live in cities or in the country gather together to one place. And the memoirs of the apostles, or the writings of the prophets, are read, as long as time permits. Then we all rise together and pray, and bread and water are brought. Bread, wine, and water are brought. So you find the observance of Sunday early on. This would, let's say, be probably later in his life, the 150s or so, about the time Polycarp died. Along about that period of time, Justin Martyr is writing and is telling how in the communities of the Christian world out there, there are people who come together on Sunday. And that's all you know. It's one of the earliest testimonies we have about it. And when challenged, apparently, on why they were doing this, he gives justification. Very interesting. This is the earliest Catholic writing. Not the earliest of all, but among the early Catholic writings on justification for Sunday worship. You can justify anything. Here's what he says, quote, "The first day God wrought day and light," going back to Genesis. "On the first day God wrought day in light. They observed the day God began his work, for he was crucified on the day before that of Saturn, and on the day after that of Saturn, which is the day of the sun, having appeared to his apostles and disciples, he taught them these things, which we have submitted to you for your consideration." He just avoids the Sabbath totally. It's become so anti the feelings, and I think primarily, again, Jewish sentiment comes in here, that you look for justification. Now you say, well, now what happened to Jesus? They got it all wrong, of course. Even by 150, the crucifixion is all off. Not understood correctly. He was crucified on the day before Saturn, uses the pagan terminology, Sabbath or Saturday. And he rose the next day afterwards, so he avoids it altogether. Therefore, the Lord had nothing to do with the Sabbath, what he's telling us. And he rose from the dead on Sunday and instructed, and besides that, that was the day, way back at the beginning, on which God made light. Now, I suppose that's, if it were all true, very good human reasoning. The interesting point is, though, God, sure enough, began his creation process in Genesis 1 on a Sunday. But what did he do during creation week? On the seventh day, he rested. And, of course, the Ten Commandments plainly look back to that event and say, we should rest on the Sabbath. That's all human reasoning. You see, men without God's Spirit. This is why I don't accept that these writings are true. I certainly don't accept Justin Martyr as being one of the original followers of the true church at all. In his dialogue, Justin Martyr continues on his justification for Sunday worship and why they are not keeping the Sabbath in the way they did. "The Sabbath is a temporary ordinance derived from Moses, which God did not intend to be kept literally, for he himself does not stop controlling the movements of the universe on that day by human reasoning. Now notice this. This will really get you if you've not read this one before. He imposed it, that is the Sabbath, in the days of Moses, solely on the Jews as a mark to single them out for punishment that they so well deserve for their infidelities. Now that's, you know, that's really the height of religious bigotry, to say God, the Creator, gave this day to the Jews and imposed it upon them so everyone else could know who they were, and they well deserve the persecution they have. And we know who they are because they keep the Sabbath. And we write yellow stars of David on their windows and make them wear them, their clothing. That's what happened in the 30s. People could know who these Jews are. It's amazing what people will reason. A little later on, we've discussed the writings of another Catholic father, as we call them, Tertullian, in the 160s to the end of the century and past. Tertullian, whom we call the father of Latin Christianity, remember. Tertullian also talks about Sunday. And he never claims any biblical authority for it. Here is what Tertullian, toward the second, the end of the, let me get this straight now, 200, okay. Here's what he said in 200, whatever century that is. In 200, give or take a little bit of time. Here's what he said. If, for these and other such rules, you insist upon having positive scripture injunction, you will find none. That is, on why the Catholic Church is observing Sunday. Somebody questioned it. Rightly so. If you insist upon having positive scripture injunction, you will find none. Tradition will be held forth to you as the originator of them. Custom as their strengthener, and faith as their preserver. How did Sunday come to be observed in the church? By the end of a couple of hundred years, it was already established as tradition. We can see from Justin Martyr the reasoning. And now Tertullian says, we have been given it by tradition, strengthened it with custom, and preserved it with faith. And that's why the Catholic Church keeps Sunday. Plain, simple, bottom line. That reason will support tradition and custom and faith. And you will either yourself perceive, or you will learn from someone who has. You will perceive it, you'll understand it, it should be crammed down your throat or else. Paraphrase it. And that's what was happening in that period of time. Amazing things were happening. Well, I've already mentioned the Council of Nicaea, in which we begin to observe Sunday law now coming into the Roman Empire. Laws about Sunday, proclaiming Sunday as a day of rest, closure of business. And at this time, the Sabbath could still be acknowledged as a day of worship, and was, as I already noted, for hundreds of years even more than this. But now at the Council of Nicaea, and this period of time, although the Sabbath could be observed, work on that day was required. And the Catholics have an interesting history with that. You could observe the Sabbath. That is, you could read scriptures, you could do these things, but work was required. And I wonder what is going to happen in the coming years ahead of us. And this rather interesting prophetic statement in the Bible about the mark of the beast in the book of Revelation. We'll hold them all in questions, but you do have historic precedent. And the Catholic Church has permitted the Sabbath, that acknowledges themselves, oh yes, sure, Saturday is the Sabbath, but we don't observe it. It's Jewish. The murderers of the Lord kept that day. We observe Sunday, but Saturday is the Sabbath. And we order you to work on that day so as you do not appear to acknowledge that Jewish day, whom God gave the Jews to single them out for punishment. I mean, this is going to be the whole reasoning, or has been historically. I won't predict that it's going to be. So you have Sunday observance coming from the misconceived idea that Christ was resurrected on Sunday. She wasn't. But more than anything else, it was the venerable day of the sun that had always been observed in the pagan world, and it just made it simply easier to do, but they had a lot of justification. Here is what from the History of the Christian Church by Schaff, who is a noted volume on church history, you should be familiar with his name, S-C-H-A-F-F, Schaff, several volume work called The History of the Christian Church. I would not recommend you purchase it unless you find it in a used bookstore at a bargain price. It's not available in any way. You'd only find it in used bookstores. He says, on the venerable day of the sun, this is looking back on how the Catholics were viewing it, on the venerable day of the sun, let the magistrates and people residing in the cities rest. Let all workshops be closed. In the country, however, persons engaged in agriculture may freely and lawfully continue their pursuits. See, the Catholics never have transferred Sabbath worship over to Sunday. The Puritans of the 17th century England and Holland and the early settlers of America and many Protestants claim you should keep Sunday today in the same manner as the Sabbath should have been observed in ancient times. But the Catholics don't enjoy that at all. Great day for bullfights. Sunday is wonderful day for football. And whatever else may suit your fancy, after you go to church, after you do your religious duty, after you do your confession, interestingly enough, most of the time in Catholic communities, on the Sabbath, Saturday. That's the most popular day for confession. So this is what was enjoined upon them. Persons engaged in agriculture may freely continue their pursuits because it often happens that another day is not so suitable for grain sowing or for vine planting, lest by neglecting the proper moment for such operations, the bounty of heaven should be lost. What about faith? What about God? I wouldn't want to do that. So that's how the Sabbath sort of came to be regarded. I'll probably read this again to you next class or two, but the Council of Laodicea, which we will come to and I'll explain more, which was a little later on in the fourth century, in the 300s, the Council of Laodicea had a canon that stated the Gospels are to be read on the Sabbath, that is Saturday, with other scriptures. And Sunday, again, becomes called the Lord's Day. We find as early as the 500s this statement. I'll just read it to you without quoting all the sources. Saturday and the Lord's Day were the two great festivals on which they always held church assemblies. And Cassian takes notice of the Egyptian services, that among them the service of the Lord's Day and the Sabbath was always the same. So now you have side-by-side observations. Certain religious activity is occurring on Saturday, certain others on Sunday, but work being required on Saturday, you have to do some work, you have to carry on, shops are open, in other words, on Sunday shops are required to be closed. Later on, in the late 300s, we have this statement, with what eyes can you behold the Lord's Day when you despise the Sabbath? Do you not perceive that they are sisters, and that in slighting the one, you affront the other? Said by a Catholic. So I'm showing here that this is not solidified. This takes time. It's going to take 1,000 years to finally stamp out the Sabbath from even the Catholic community itself. But it begins to be stamped out, and quite effectively so in the 300s, as I mentioned. In the 400s, and we'll come to this man, and I'll tell you more about him later, one of the most famous of all, probably in fact the most outstanding Catholic scholar in all history is Augustine. He's in the 400s, and I'll come to him and give you more about him later. But I want to read you his statement on the Sabbath and Sunday. The holy doctors of the church have decreed that all the glory of the Jewish Sabbath is transferred to it, that is, to Sunday. Let us therefore keep the Lord's Day as the ancients were commanded to do the Sabbath. So in the time of Augustine, he advocated the transferal of all the Sabbath law to Sunday. Never was accepted by the church. But it shows you how he was viewing it. And then finally, one last quote. Good, I'm going to be right on time today. One last quote I wanted to give you by a modern Catholic writer, Cardinal Gibbon, in his book, Faith of Our Fathers. Cardinal Gibbon, G-I-B-B-O-N, this is not any relationship to Edward Gibbon, who wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, but a modern work by a Roman Catholic cardinal. Cardinal Gibbon, his book is entitled Faith of Our Fathers. He says, and I quote, "A rule of faith, or a competent guide to heaven, must be able to instruct in all the truths necessary for salvation. Now, the Scriptures alone do not contain all the truths which a Christian is bound to believe, nor do they explicitly enjoin all the duties which he is obliged to practice. Not to mention other examples, is not every Christian obliged to sanctify Sunday and abstain on that day from unnecessary servile work? Is not the observance of this law among the most prominent of our sacred duties? But you may read the Bible from Genesis to Revelation, and you will not find a single line authorizing the sanctification of Sunday. The Scriptures enforce the religious observance of Saturday, a day which we never sanctified." And that tells you the story. That's up to date. This is a modern Catholic leader looking back and tells you really what happened. So that's in a nutshell, without going into a great deal of detail, but giving you some sources for your own study, how Sunday came to be the day of worship in the Christian church, a day which God's people never enjoined, never participated in, always were separated by it, and often persecuted for it. And in 325, as we've talked about before, the church has to go underground or get their property confiscated. They get driven away into the wilds, and all those things happen. Okay, we'll pick it up then next time.